Well, today we complete chapter one as we continue with what we're calling the Torah Project. I've been typing my little fingers down to the quick this week and trying to get everything in chapter one finished up. So what we're going to do as we go through the notes, I'm just going to be sharing some things, but I'm going to go to what I have written for some of the parts. So if you hear me reading some things, it's because I'm reading some things. And let's begin. I've mentioned before that the Bible, the book of Genesis, starts with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the letter Bet. The letter Bet looks like this. Okay? And this has bothered the rabbis because they say, since God is the Lord and Master of the universe, since God is the creator, shouldn't the Bible begin with the first letter of the alphabet, the letter Aleph, which is the Lord and Master of the alphabet? The word Aleph means Lord or Master. So shouldn't that be the first letter? Why does it start with the second letter of the alphabet? So, what they have derived, what they've come to, is the realization that the creation is actually secondary. There's something more important than the creation. That there's a higher purpose for which the creation was created. So the creation starts with this second letter, but this higher, more important thing starts with Aleph. And this is where you find that thing. In Exodus 20, verses 1 and 2, this is what it says. Then Elohim spoke all these words, saying, I am Adonai your Elohim, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of servitude. And what is this section here in Exodus 20? What is this the beginning of? It's the Ten Commandments. Yes, God up to this point has been speaking only to Moses. And he tells him, this is what I want you to do. I want you to gather the people. I'm going to descend upon the mountain. I'll appear upon the mountain. You set up these stones as boundary stones. Don't let anything come close to the mountain or it'll die. Keep the cattle and the people away. Prepare yourselves because I'm going to speak to the whole group. And so sure enough, the big day comes, the day of Shavuot, or as it's also known as Pentecost. And God speaks from atop Mount Sinai, and the only time in history where the entire mixed multitude of people, where a whole nation of people hear God speak audibly. What a day that was. And the first words out of God's mouth are, I am Adonai, your Elohim. And here's what it looks like in Hebrew. Notice what the first letter is, Aleph. Oh, there's nothing up there. Oh, why isn't there anything up there? Yep, I'm all plugged in. Yep. Well, I can see it. And if you can't see it, that's okay. You can just follow along. I'm all plugged in up here, so I'm not sure. So they'll get it figured out. They always do. So these words, I am Adonai, your Elohim. Ani Adonai Elohecha. Begin with the letter Aleph. Because this begins what are called the Ten Commandments. Now, here's a problem. The Bible never calls these the Ten Commandments. Nowhere in the Bible are the Ten Commandments called the Ten Commandments. That's a man-made thing. Three times in the Bible, these Ten Commandments are referred to, but they're never called the Ten Commandments. They're called the Esrat Hadvarim, the Ten Words. The Ten Words, not the Ten Commandments. Because you see, this first commandment is not a commandment. It's a statement. I am Adonai, your Elohim, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's number one. Now, I know in Christianity has other traditions. They don't make this number one. They make the next one number one, and they split one of them in two to make two and three. And then finally, when you get down to about four, then they get on track. But traditionally, this is number one. This has always been number one. If you could go back in a time machine and ask Yeshua, the apostles, what is the first of the 10 words, they would say, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's number one, and it's not a commandment. The other 9 are commandments. Okay, everybody with me? So what we see here is that the world was created so that the commandments could be lived out. That is the purpose of the world. It's like the stage is built to perform the play, but the play is much more important than the stage. I think of Shakespeare's plays. These plays are studied and read and analyzed, even though all the stages they were ever performed on cease to exist. They are no longer in existence. Stages are gone. But we build new stages all the time, perform these ancient plays, these old plays. How are we doing?
Oh, okay.
I thought that you needed me to do something. Okay. People who are listening on the internet, we're just having some trouble getting the iPad to somehow connect with the screen, but everything's on here. So, yeah. So it's just one of those days, huh? All right, we're not going to worry about it. This gives you all the more purpose, reason to go to the internet tomorrow and just download the notes, and you can see everything you're supposed to be seeing now. Even my little chicken scratches on there, okay? So the world is created, and that's secondary, for the sake of this primary thing, which is God's Torah. And God begins to give the Torah to Israel on Mount Sinai. Now you might think, well, Grant, there are a lot of statements and sentences in the Bible that start with an Aleph. How do you know it's this particular thing? Aren't you making a big deal out of this? Well, there are other things that support this idea. For one, when you look at the first chapter of Genesis, you'll see over and over and over and over, it says, and God said. In Hebrew, it's Vayomer Elohim. Vayomer Elohim. Vayomer Elohim. And guess how many times that phrase appears in the first chapter? No, 10 times. Well, the rabbis say it's 10 times, but you count, you'll only see 9. It doesn't appear in verse 1. Verse 1 just starts, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. But they say, but he had to speak for the heavens and the earth to appear. So it's implied in verse 1, but you'll find it exactly 9 times in the rest of the chapter. So look what's happening here. The 10 commandments, there's only 9 commandments. The first one's not a commandment, it's a statement. In Genesis 1, God speaks. He speaks 10 times, but the first time it's implied. But then it specifically states the next 9 times when he does speak. Here's something else. When you take the 10 commandments, the first 5 line up with the second 5. The 5 on the first tablet line up with the 5 on the second tablet. The first 5 have to do with our relationship with God. And each one of those commandments, each one of those words or statements contain God's name, Yod Heh Vav Heh. But the second set of 5 do not contain his name. Those are about our relationship with one another. But they exactly align with each other. And you'll see that commandment 1 aligns with commandment 6. Commandment 2 aligns with commandment 7. You'll see that they just go right on through and they have a direct connection with one another. Well, when you look at the 6 days of creation, guess what? The first 3 days perfectly aligned with the last 3 days. For example, on day 1, what comes forth? God separates light from darkness. Then what does he do on day 4? He takes the light and the darkness, and he places the vessels for the light in the heavens, and he makes the sun to rule over the day, and the moon to rule over the darkness, the night. So he divides on day 1, light from darkness, and then he places the vessels to rule over the light and the dark on day 4. What does he do on day 2? On day 2, he separates the waters above from the waters below, and there's this expanse in between called the heavens, Shemayim. Correspond over here to day 5. Was it day five? He creates fish for the waters below and the birds to inhabit the waters above in the heavens, you see. Then you've got days 3 and 6. What does he do on days 3 and 6? On day 3, he separates the water from the dry land and the vegetation appears. Then on day 6, he creates the animals to live on the dry land. And he creates man to have rule over the animals and to tend the garden, to tend the vegetation that appeared on day 3. You get the idea? So you see, with the Ten Commandments, I'm going to call them that because we're used to it, the first 5 align with the second 5. On the 6 days of creation, the first 3 align with the last 3. There are all these correspondences. And when we get to the end of the teaching, you're going to see one more extremely important correspondence between the creation and the giving of the Torah. But I want to revisit that principle. On the first days, 3 days of creation, the 3 days of restoration, there's division. Day 1 divides light from the darkness. Day 2 divides the waters from the waters. Day 3 divides the dry land from the waters. Division, division, division. But in days 4, 5, and 6, there's filling and filling and filling. This is a powerful principle we find right here in the opening of the Bible. And the principle is this. The principle is that before God fills, before God brings fruitfulness, there always has to be some kind of cutting. He cuts the light from the dark. The later he fills the dark with the moon, with the stars, and the daytime with the sunshine. But there's always a pruning before there's a fruitfulness. There's always a cutting away and a removing before there's an adding. You put off the old man before you put on the new. You have to put away sin before you can put on righteousness. You have to take one thing off to put another thing on. You see this later when later on when we see God give instructions about how Eve was created. It's in chapter 2. He shows the creation of Eve. What does he have to do? Take Adam and cut him in half. Cut him in half. He doesn't take a rib. That's nonsense. He took his side right down through the middle. Cut him into 2 pieces, and out of one of those halves, he forms his bride. But there has to be this division before there can be this fullness. And of course, the ultimate fulfillment of this principle is Messiah being cut off. And Daniel says he will be cut off. Messiah will come and be cut off for his people. He's nailed to the cross. He's dead, executed. But what comes out of that? Fruitfulness. A change of the entire world, the salvation of mankind. So it's pretty incredible. So don't be surprised at this principle in your own life. It's the way things work. Whenever you say, ouch, something just got cut, then anticipate fruitfulness. Ouch, that hurt, I just lost such and such. All right, anticipate fruitfulness. Pruning brings increased fruitfulness. That's how God works, and it's right there on the first page of the Bible. You find these important principles located right up in front in the Scriptures. And this is an extremely important Scripture in God's economy. I guess we don't need that. There we go. Now, one of the other questions you might have is the gospel. If the gospel is so important, then why isn't it located closer to the front of the book? Don't you put the most important things right up front? I know this is a question I'd asked myself many years ago, decades ago. Why isn't the gospel found near the front? You have to read 3/4 through the Bible to get to it. And if the whole Bible is about the gospel, the good news, if this is the one thing we're supposed to be talking about all the time, why do you have to go so far into the Scriptures before finally it shows up? But what we realize is that the gospel is on the first page of the Bible. It's just the gospel is not a pill we take. It's a process under which we go, that we experience. Don't think of it as a salvation as a line in the sand. You're either on this side of the line or that side of the line. That is a human construct. It's not a scriptural one. Salvation is a process. We'll talk about this later as we go through the scriptures. It is a process that begins with the spirit, and then it moves on into the soul, and then eventually we get new bodies. But it is a long process. It takes a lifetime. I do believe that once that process begins, it continues until it's fully completed. But not until Revelation 12 do you see, now is salvation fully come. So we have a ways to go before salvation fully comes to the bride, to us. In the meantime, we're in the process. And this is why so many times in the apostolic scriptures, it talks about those of you who are being saved, we who are being saved, we who are going through the process of salvation. And it's very clear in the Greek, though it's kind of murky in the English translations. So what we see in these 6 days of restoration, if we know how to look at them, we will see six phases in the restoration of your soul, of my soul, of any human soul. And there's a precious saying in the Talmud. It's in Tractate Sanhedrin, page 37a. It says, whoever destroys a soul, it is considered as if he destroyed an entire world. And whoever saves a life, it is considered as if he saved an entire world. I think it's a very wise statement. If you saw the movie Schindler's List, right at the very end of the movie, all these Jewish people, young and old, men and women, that Oskar Schindler had saved and rescued from the Holocaust, they know they're about to be set free, that the Nazis have run away and the other forces, opposing forces, are moving in. And they wanted to make a gift for Oskar Schindler. You remember what they did? The only thing they had to give were the gold fillings in their teeth. So they removed the gold fillings in their teeth until they had enough gold to make a ring. And they made a mold, and they cast this ring, and engraved on the ring was this phrase, whoever saves a life, it is as if he saved an entire world. And that was their gift to Oskar Schindler, this quote from the Talmud. We need to quit thinking of people as small, as cheap, as expendable, as plain, and start to think of each individual as an entire world. Now, that world may be tohu and vohu. It may be dark and empty, confused and chaotic and unstructured, but it's still a whole world. And just as the world is completely, utterly complex, every human being is as well. People who are easy to understand are usually simple people. But as people grow and develop, we begin to realize they're very complicated. We are very complicated. How complicated is your body? We have several physicians here. Any of you completely, totally understand the human body? No. Of all your studies, you probably realize how little you understand the human body, because it's so completely complex. It's an entire world. The soul is just as complex. I promise you it is. The soul is just as complex, is capable of just as great a things, and it's also prone to just as many complications and illnesses. So quit thinking as you have of a human being. We're very complex. So as we go through and look at these 6 days of restoration, I want us to look and see how they apply to the restoration of the human soul. So as I go through the teaching, what I'm going to do is when we get to the place where it particularly applies to the human soul, I'm just going to read what I've written for that day. Now, remember, what was the earth like before God started restoring it? It says it was tohu and vohu, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Now, tohu means confused, chaotic, detached from reality. That's how it's used in Scripture. That kind of describes a person before they come to the knowledge of God, before they come to a relationship with God. They're confused. Wonder why there's so much confusion in the world? Because you have a lot of people who are tohu. It's chaotic. It's unordered. It's detached from reality. Remember that our definition for reality is the word truth. Truth is reality. Reality is truth. Okay? Truth is reality. What is actually real is truth. And then it says it was vohu. Vohu means without structure. And then it tells you it was empty, and it tells you there was dark in the depths, in the spirit, spiritual darkness. There must have been some light, a little bit on the surface, but in the depths it was completely, utterly devoid of light. Dark in the depths. So what's the first thing God does? This is what it says about day one. On day one, it says, and Elohim said, let there be light, and there was light. That's the first thing. The first part of the solution of the restoration of a human soul is to bring light to it. To bring light, to illuminate it. And then it goes on and says that he separated the light from the darkness. Called the light day, called the darkness night. It's morning and evening, day one. So we see light coming to the earth. We see a division between light and darkness. The confusion is gone now. We can discern what is truth, what is deception. And that's one of the very first things that a person has to come to the realization of. There is truth, there is reality, and there is deception. There is those things that simply are not true. They are not real. We have to start realizing the difference. One of the biggest things I encounter with people is that they think things that are unreal are real. And then they think the real things aren't. They have all kinds of fears. And yet the things they fear are phantoms. They're not real at all. And they think having fame is real. No, it's not. They think having wealth is real. It isn't. But then the spiritual things, righteousness and humility, that's nothing. And so they're in confusion. You know, when you're in total darkness, then all of a sudden the things aren't real get magnified. You can't see the reality. And so little sounds, squeaks in the house, little bumps in the night. It's like, oh, someone's breaking in. Something's happening. And the unreal all of a sudden takes on the significance it doesn't deserve. And I see a hand up, so let's get a microphone over to Carla here. We do have some microphones out, right? Yeah, there we go. Yes, yeah, Carla. Yes.
And it was like, what's the so dark big deal? So I looked in the art store to see what they had to say. And they essentially say that the darkness was not just the absence of light, it was like a thick fog. It had real estate.
Yeah.
It actually occupied space. And so they really couldn't see where to go. Light didn't work. And they kept trying to fire up the lights and it just didn't work. So is that the type of darkness that, I mean, that sounds like what you're talking about.
It sure does. And I'm sorry, Carla. Melanie's a miracle worker. What in the world did you do, Melanie? I don't know. She did something, but all of a sudden there's light where there was darkness. So anyways, hey. Oh, that's clever. Awesome. That's great. Okay. So, Carl, I was listening to what you said. Yeah, I think it's that kind of a darkness that has its own kind of identity with it. And otherwise, why would God need to make a vessel to rule over it if it's nothing? Yeah. You know, I was, I don't know why it occurred to me, but earlier after the Torah service, I was up here talking. I don't know why, but I remember being at Disney World. And Lindsay and I were there together, and they had this one attraction you went in. It's supposed to be like on a spaceship, and you're doing this intergalactic voyage of some sort. So we're all in these seats in a circle, and there were ranks of these. We're all in a circle, and you're strapped into the seat, and it had this high back. And then somehow an alien gets into the spaceship, and you hear everything go, you know, and the thing shakes, and all the lights go out. And then you hear somebody say, oh no, it's in the room with us. And you have these stereo headphones in your seat, and you can hear it moving around. And then you hear it move right behind you, and then air starts blowing on you because it's blowing through its nostrils, and then a little spray hits you. You know, it's a little alien spit hits the back of your neck. And I mean, it is so real. And then there's heat that comes out. You feel the hot breath on the back of your neck. So why don't people all go running and screaming out of this attraction? Well, for one thing, we're strapped in. But the other thing is, although everything in your physical body is telling you there's an alien behind you and he's about ready to eat you, there's a deeper reality where you know the truth. I'm at Disney World. I paid to be sitting in this chair with the alien. And I'm having fun, you know? And this is so wild, but it's not real. For some people, though, that part's turned off. And the alien is real and it's not. And, oh my goodness, fear controls so many people. Because the body's saying one thing, but truth in the heart says, no, don't believe it. Don't believe it. It's not real. Yeah, microphone to Robin here, please.
Like you said, it seems so typical that it's in the physical darkness that those monsters under the bed start to feel so real.
Yeah.
And I think that for those of us who are prone to fear at times, we inadvertently feed that monster.
Mm-hmm.
And we give it credibility by entertainment and dialoguing with it and believing it. And then the anxiety grows. And then our grip on reality loosens. And it gets very, very, very difficult.
Yes.
And a very practical hint that has been helpful to me during those moments during the dark when I was believing enough lies to become very afraid is when a loving husband takes me by the hand and walks me outside and makes me look at the sky and say, look at the stars, moon, who created it, everything's in its place, including you and I, everything's okay. He's still in charge. And I'm grateful that he's in charge, and I'm grateful that I'm coming.
I'm grateful you're my woman. Amen. Thank you for that. And Sharon, let's pass it up here. Thank you, Robin.
So I think a corollary question would be, what is the purpose of darkness, physical darkness existing within our world? And, you know, we're created to need rest in the absence of restorative sleep. We're not healthy, and that's the proper time for to be sleeping. People who don't sleep when it's dark for whatever reason frequently have a lot of trouble.
Yes.
Because of it. But, I mean, that's something to think about. Why do we have this nighttime as part of our existence?
That's a great question. It's one I address in the book that I'm writing. And the reason God created darkness, because it says he forms the light and creates the darkness. So why did he create the darkness? So we would know what light is. If there was never darkness, we would not know what light is, any more than a fish knows it's wet. Okay? Because that's all we know. So when there's darkness, it's like, now I understand what light is. You have to have the absence of something to understand the reality of something. You have to have its absence. So, but that was a good question. I think it was a pretty good answer, too, actually, but I'm not going to toot my own horn. Okay, let's... Now, it does say in Genesis 1:2 that there is darkness over the face of the deep. It says, and the Spirit of Elohim, the Spirit of God, was hovering over the surface of the waters. Now, this is important. Before God begins restoration, his Spirit is already there. It's at work. And Yeshua refers to God's Spirit working in the world in John 16:8, where he says, and he, when he comes, or a more accurate translation would probably be, and it when it comes, God's Spirit is an it, by the way. It's not a he. In fact, in Hebrew, spirit is feminine. It's a she. But I don't even want to start putting she down there. I get in all kinds of trouble. But when it comes, we'll convince the world concerning three things: sin, righteousness, and judgment. It will convince the world of sin. All will know that they have sin in their lives, and everybody in the world knows this. They may want to fight it, may want to deny it, but every person on the planet knows they've fallen short. It will convince the world of righteousness. In other words, all will know that there is a standard of righteousness. Everybody knows there's a standard of righteousness. And some people try to deny anything that's righteous. And they'll want to change laws to embrace unrighteousness, because who are you to set the standards? Who are you to enforce your beliefs on us? You understand? And so there are no standards. Just throw standards out. And God's Spirit will convince the world of judgment. In other words, they know that there's going to be an accounting for their lives at a future point. And no matter where you go in the world, no matter the darkest jungle, what society, culture you go to, these three things are built into their culture and their religions: sin, righteousness, and an accounting to come. It's there. More sophisticated cultures try to deny these three things, but it's like Shakespeare says, you seem to protest a bit too much. You know, you're fighting pretty hard against these things. Which reveals the fact you really do know that they are true. So, day one, six stages in the restoration of the soul. Day one, the lights come on. And what we see is that God's word is spiritual light. We have to understand that when God said, "Yehi or, light be," the next two words are "vayhi or," light was. The words are the same. The first two words are the same as the last two words, just separated by a vav. In other words, what God speaks is the reality. All language, whether spoken or written or sign language, all is symbolic. All words are symbols. When God speaks, those symbols that reveal his mind, those symbols become physical reality. When you see trees, you're seeing his words that he spoke. When you see the clouds and the sky and the animals and the earth and the waters, you're seeing God's speech made three-dimensionally and made physical reality. And the rabbis refer to this as God's sustaining utterance, that he sings forth universe and he continues to sing, and that's what upholds the entire universe. If he paused to take a breath, it would all just collapse and disappear. The natural world is God's speech. That means it all has meaning. It all reveals what's in his mind. When you speak, you take what's invisible, the thoughts in your mind, you put them into symbols. And then when someone else picks up those symbols, they translate them back into your thoughts. So they have in their minds what is in your mind. God's speech becomes nature. And if we know how to read it, we can know him better. You know, Yeshua and the writers of the scriptures, they did not have to scratch around trying to find something in the world to illustrate truth. Everything in the world was a product of God's speech, and therefore his truth, because his word is truth. It's a completely different way of thinking, isn't it? There's an awareness of one's true state, because when the lights come on, you begin to recognize what darkness is. It's awareness of something outside of and above ourselves, because the light comes from up there, not from down here. The light was there. I was in the depths of darkness, but now there's something coming from outside of myself, from above myself, from a different realm. Light and truth, the same thing, make us aware of darkness and deception. Light and truth begin to transform confusion into clarity. And this is what I wrote about the first day. Just as God's first act of restoration of this world was to speak light into it, likewise, his first act of restoration of a person's soul is to speak light into it. Just as light reveals the physical reality around us, so spiritual light reveals the spiritual reality, which is truth. Without the light of truth, falsehood would not be revealed as being false. Light makes us aware of darkness. If it were not for light, we would not be aware of darkness any more than a fish is aware that it is wet. Also, just as the light came from above to below, so the light of God's truth comes from a higher realm into the lower one in which we live. Does that make sense? All right. Well, let's go to day two. Now, day two is not called a good day. It's the only day of the six where God did not say, and it is good. On day two, this is what happens. You'll find this in verses 6-8. And Elohim said, be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it be to separate the waters toward the waters. And Elohim made the expanse and separated the waters which were beneath the expanse and the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so. And Elohim called the expanse Shemayim, heavens. And there was evening and there was morning, a second day. Not called a good day. Why isn't it a good day? One of the reasons it may not have been called good is God wasn't done with the waters yet. On day three, he's going to separate the waters from the dry land, and that was good. Another possibility is that on day one, when he separated light from darkness, they don't belong together anyway, so separating them was good. On day three, dry land and water don't belong together. Separating them, that's good. But when you separate water from water, you're separating something that's the same thing. He doesn't call that good. Which raises a question. Is this separation of the water from the water a temporary thing? We see that in a perfect world, in Revelation 21, the new heavens and new earth, there are no seas. I saw the new heavens and new earth, and it says, and there was no sea. There were no seas at all. Where did the waters go? We know there's a stream that proceeds from God's throne. But as far as seas, as far as vast stretches of land being underneath salt water, that doesn't happen in the new earth. It's almost as if the waters belong up there and not down here. And when they come down here in great amounts, it's destructive. After all, the earth originally was destroyed by this flood. We see in Noah's world creation working backwards and the land once again being covered with water, and it brings death to the world. We see when Israel leaves Egypt, they cross the Red Sea, but when it closes up, it brings death. We see in the story of Jonah how the seas bring death. And all through the scriptures, the seas are pictures of things being tossed to and fro. We see the beast rising out of the seas in the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. In fact, in Jewish thinking, the seas were hell. That's why there were so few fishermen in Israel in the first century. That's why you didn't see houses built close to the ocean, close to the seas in the first century. It stayed back from it. People did not like the seas. And in fact, what did the swine do, the pigs do, when Yeshua drove the demons out of the demoniac? They went into the swine, what did they do? Right down to the sea. It's almost like there's this attraction to the seas by the demonic. Later, at the great white throne judgment, and it says, I saw this throne set up, the books were opened, the sea gave it the dead which were in it. And death and hell gave the dead which were in them. Why is the sea this separate thing? All right. So, the seas don't seem to be a good thing when they're on earth. But, when you go back to Revelation twice, it describes God's throne room, and it says, around his throne was a glassy sea. No waves, no ripples, perfectly calm. It's like that's where the waters belong, not down here. So water given from heaven in measured amounts as rain and dew, that's good. We have to have that. But when it comes down, gushing down in buckets, like it's doing in Texas, and when you have the oceans, not good. It's almost as if the waters belong there, not here. Just some thinking. But I wanted to look at this word for heaven. The word for heaven, heavens, is the word Shemayim. And this is it here in red. If we divide it between the first and second letter, what we have here is the word water. Maim is water. But the first letter is the letter of fire, the letter Shin. It's the letter of fire. We'll be looking at that more as we go through Genesis. And wherever we find fire and water dwelling together in harmony and in peace, we find God's presence. In fact, when you go to Revelation 15, that description of God's throne room, it says, around the throne was this glassy sea. And shooting through the sea were flashes of fire, flashes of lightning. That doesn't happen in the natural world. We'll be looking at examples. When you see fire and water dwelling in harmony with one another, God is always present in a powerful way. But I want us to look at this word in a different way. I want us to look at it this way. These first two letters spell the word there, T-H-E-R-E, there. If I say, oh, it's over there, I'd say it's Sham in Hebrew. But if we take letters 2, 3, and 4, it spells the word water. So if I were to say there is water, I'd say Sham Mayim. Put them together, it's Shemayim. And in ancient Israel, and even today, what did they rely upon for their water? They rely upon the rain. So they can look up at the sky and say, Sham Mayim, Shemayim. There is water, the heavens. You see? So Shemayim is a place of the waters. He talks about the waters above. So on day two, it's not called a good day. Because there's this great gulf that is set between us below and God above. As a gulf we can't cross. This is what I wrote about the restoration of the soul on this day. So what maybe we learned about God's restoration of the human soul from the activities of the second day? Basically, just one thing. There's a distance between me here below and God up above. There's a fixed expanse between us that I cannot cross, and this is not good. Though I am made in my Creator's image, I am distanced from Him. I am separated from my source and feel like I am drowning. And by the light He provided on day one, I now realize my desperate condition. Because on day two, the whole world is still covered with water. Picture yourself in a world where there's no dry land. The light comes on, you realize there is no place to stand around here. There's no land at all. I am drowning. And you begin to realize how desperate your condition is. This is not a good thing. But it can have a good result. We go to day three. And day three, this is what it says. Then Elohim, it starts in chapter 1, verse 9. Then Elohim said, let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And Elohim called the dry land earth, and the mikvah of the waters he called seas. The gathering of the word of the waters. The word gathering, there's the word mikvah. And that is the word for a baptismal tank, an immersion tank. And Elohim saw that it was good. And Elohim said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And Elohim saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a third day. That word mikvah is very specific, because we see the dry land emerging from the gathering of waters, from the mikvah. What was dead and under the water is now brought forth in life forms. To a Hebrew reader, this is a powerful image. Because just as the world had been destroyed by water, it is now emerging. And just as a person goes through the mikvah, it's a picture of death. When he comes out, it's a picture of new life. Throughout Judaism, immersion is called being born again. It's a rebirth. Coming out of death into a place of life. And now we see the earth emerging out of the waters. And there's newness of life now on the surface. There's nourishment there. So it's a powerful picture. And twice on this day, God says, it is good. He says it two times. It's a doubly good day. This is why in Israel and in Judaism in general, if you want to get married, do it on a Tuesday. Okay? Not the first day and Sunday, not the second day, which is definitely not a good, not on Monday. Monday's bad. Not good day. But then Tuesday, it's a doubly good day because twice on Tuesday, on the third day, God said it is good. So that's a good day to do things. Here's what I wrote about this day. In light of the discussion above, it is not difficult to see how the two things that came to be on this day apply to the regeneration of a person's soul. First, just as the dry land emerged from the water, so a drowning soul emerges from a place of death and is given a place to stand. His feet begin to find their footing on the rock, and he begins to experience a degree of rest. Second, life appears on the surface. This phenomena is a typical experience for those who begin their first tentative steps toward God. A new level of existence opens up to them, and they experience the beginnings of a richer day-to-day life. It is an aha experience that they thought only happened to others, but never to them. At this point in a soul's development, whatever he thought was good before is twice as good now. Life starts to look beautiful. The danger here, however, is to cease one's forward journey thinking this is good enough. So many people reach this point. Think, God, this is good enough. And it is definitely better than anything they've had before. But God says, no, I'm only half done with you. We're only halfway. There's more. Don't ever stop halfway with God. I always say that, you know, there's nobody more miserable than a half-redeemed person. Somebody's gone halfway towards restoration of their soul and then quit. You talk place of misery, that's it, right there. Miserable place to be. So we come to day four. Now, day four, five, and six is when God fills the things he separated in days one, two, and three. On day four, this is what it says. It starts in verse 14. Then Elohim said, let there be luminaries in the expanse of the heavens to separate between the day and the night. And they will be for otot, signs, and for moedim, appointed times, and for days and years. And they shall be for luminaries in the expanse of the heavens to shine upon the earth. And it was so. And Elohim made the two large luminaries, the larger one to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, the stars also. And Elohim placed them in the expanse of the heavens to shine on the earth, and to rule the day and the night, and to separate between the light and the darkness. And Elohim saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fourth day. You know, I keep thinking of that word, to rule. The word there, to rule, there are different words in Hebrew for rule, but the word here is the word mashal, and that's where you get the word mishle. Mashal is also a word for a proverb or a parable. Do you know that? A mashal, the book of Proverbs, is called mishle. It's mashals, proverbs and parables. So to rule, and the word for a parable or a proverb are the same word. Because you see, a parable is a picture that allows you to rule over a truth and to hold that truth and to use that truth and draw that truth close and to apply that truth to situations. The way it's described is like a rope on a bucket. You can carry the bucket of water without a rope, but you get yourself soaking wet. If you have it on a rope, you can just swing it right along and walk, and everything's cool. You don't slosh the water around. A mashal allows you to lay hold of truth. And he gave the lights to mashal over the light and the darkness. It's a pretty neat parallel, so you can think about that more on your own. But we see here that light, or truth, is more specific and defined. We see light on the first day, but now, specific lights. I see stars, thousands, millions of them. And there's the moon moving around. And there's the sun. Now light has precision to it. And it has meaning. Because what did he set the lights there for? It says, and they'll be for signs, for otot. And throughout the scriptures, you see signs in the heavens. The star that announced Messiah's birth was a sign in the heavens. Joel talks about signs in the heavens. Revelation, it talks about signs in the heavens. And we know that in ancient times, the names of the constellations that referred to in Job, and I think it's Hosea or Haggai, starts naming the constellations, giving them meaning. They tell the story. There are some wonderful books out there about how the ancient names of the constellations and the stars comprise them tell the story of the gospel. It's pretty incredible. So it's these signs. The word otot also means letters, like letters of the alphabet. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. But it says also for the Moedim, not seasons like spring, summer, fall, and winter. That's not what it says. The word seasons is not a good translation. It's a very specific word, Moedim, appointed times. If you want to know what the Moedim are, you go to Leviticus chapter 23. And I think, I didn't put the verse on the screen. But in Leviticus 23, it says, it's in verses 1 and 2. Adonai spoke again to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, Adonai's Moedim, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations. My Moedim are these." And he goes on to describe the Sabbath, Passover, unleavened bread, Pentecost or Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Feast of Tabernacles. These are God's appointed times. We need to be very careful. We never, ever call these Jewish holidays. They are not Jewish holidays. These are God's appointed times. And long before he gave the Torah, he wound up the clock and he set it precisely and set it loose in the heavens for time thousands of years later when men would begin to observe God's appointed times. From the very time of the creation and restoration, he was looking ahead to the day when the sons of Adam and Eve would meet together with him. Think about that. The Moedim. This word Moed, you find it many times. The tabernacle, I think it's hundreds of times, is called the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. It's the same word. It's where God and man meet together. But we don't have a tabernacle, but we have times when God and we can meet together. And we would do well to acknowledge these times and to enter into them. So we begin to realize that the creation has meaning. We realize that time is a gift and it's passing. We realize that we are under authority because now we see authority in the world. He placed the sun and the moon to have authority to rule over the light and the dark. We begin to realize there is an authority in this universe. There's greater discernment between truth and falsehood. I have precise, specific light now. Though the environment may change, light and dark, day and night, day and night, day and night, right? God runs the world. It's all part of his plan. Even the changes when the lights go away. How does this parallel with the restoration of the soul? Though light was revealed on the first day, it now becomes more specific and defined. The person undergoing regeneration becomes more aware that the light carries precise messages that are given to instruct and guide him in his journey. By the way, what did God give us as a light, a lamp to our feet and a light to our path? Torah, right? I think these lights in the heavens, these heavenly lights, that's the heavenly light we find in God's word. It's a spiritual light. At this stage in the regeneration of the human soul, the person begins to realize that the creation has meaning. See, a person who's an atheist, a person who doesn't believe in God, creation doesn't have a meaning because there's no meaner behind it to give it meaning. It just happened. It's just a phenomenon that happened. But when you begin to realize there's a creator, then if there's a creator, there's a mind who created the creation just the way he did, and it must have meaning somehow to him and to his creation, to me. So at this point, the creation itself begins to have real meaning. The creation, including the heavenly bodies, are the product of a grand designer for the purpose of guiding his creatures below. The person realizes that time is a gift and is not to be wasted. It is to be used instead to draw nearer to the creator. The person begins to also realize that he is under authority. He is subject to the Creator above and should thus organize his life according to God's wishes and instructions, his moedim, his appointed times. Just as God placed the luminaries so as to divide the day from the night, a person begins to discern more clearly between truth and falsehood. More clearly between truth and falsehood. The real and the fake. Between light and darkness. He also realizes that life has cycles. And no matter how the environment may change, God is in control and runs the world perfectly. Then we come to day 5. I call this abundant life, and it starts in verse 20. And Elohim said, let the waters teem with swarms of living souls. Your translation says living creatures, better fix it. Living souls. Nefeshkaya. And that flyers that fly over the earth, over the face of the expanse of the heavens. And Elohim created the large Taninim. Now, yours might say sea creatures, sea monsters, big fish, or whatever. We don't know how to translate that word, so I just leave it in Hebrew, Taninim. And every living soul that moves, with which the water swarmed according to their kinds, and every flying flyer after its kind, and Elohim saw that it was good. And Elohim blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters and the seas. Let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fifth day. Now, you may be surprised to know that all animals, whether they're fish, birds, beasts, creepy crawlies, they are all called living souls, every last one of them. Now think, well, wait a minute. It says later in chapter 2, God breathed into Adam's nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Yeah, that's right. And we'll get into this next time, but you have to realize that the animals came into existence because God spoke. Just spoke. He's here, he speaks there, and it happens over there. So their souls come from his speech. Adam's soul didn't. God didn't speak Adam into existence. He put his lips right on Adam's face, and no words involved. See, how do you speak? Where do the words come from? You have to have your breath, then turn into something secondary, into words. With Adam, God skipped in between words. He just took his very essence and made it Adam's very essence. So yeah, Adam became a living soul. But his connection with the one who created him was much deeper, much more intimate, came from a much higher place. And because God didn't just speak him into existence, Adam himself could speak, which is something the animals can't do. But that's for next time, all right? And here's what this has to do with the restoration of the soul. Recall that as God started his work of restoration, his spirit was hovering over the face of the deep. Now we see life in those same depths. Remember how there's darkness in the depths? And then God's spirit was hovering over the face of the waters. Now we see life in those depths. There are fish created. Where once there was just darkness, now there's life. There's a deeper life in the depths. His spirit was hovering over the face of the deep. Now we see life in those same depths. On the third day, we saw life on the surface. But now on the fifth day, we see life in the depths. This is a picture of spiritual life. And not only that, we also see a higher life on the surface. There are birds. Even the upper realms are not now filled with life as birds fill the sky. Both the depths and the heights are pictures of the spiritual realms. And now they are both filled with life. Isn't that amazing? This is a beautiful picture. Amazing picture. But you notice I put here the enemy is present. Why do I put that? Where do we see the enemy appear? You go back to that word taninim. Let the waters teem with swarms of living souls, and let flyers fly over the earth. And Elohim created the taninim. You see, when you go to the story in Exodus chapter 7 where Moses and Aaron appear before Pharaoh and the magicians, remember, cast down Aaron's staff, or Moses' staff, what does it become? Serpent, right? That's not the word that's used. It became a tanin. And then Pharaoh's servants threw down their staffs. They became taninim. And Moses' tanin swallowed up their taninim. So I'm not so sure these are great sea monsters. I think they are serpents. Because later on, I think it's in Deuteronomy, refers to the venom of the taninim. So these things, these whatever they are, they do have poison. It must be some particular kind of serpent that is poisonous. And we see it come into being here. So even in the midst of the abundance of life and the depths, life and the heights, we see the enemy right on the sill, right on the windowsill, on the threshold, I should say. Yet God says it's all good. Why is it good for us to have an enemy? Well, go back to the very first teaching we did about how God wants us to have free will. That's all in the first word of the Bible. Without an enemy, there'd be no free will. God wants us to have free will. Then day six. Yes, a question over here. Let's get a microphone to you, Valerie.
In my Bible, it says God created the great, uses sea monsters. Mm-hmm. Does it say, what is it?
It doesn't say great. It just says taninim. They're using three words to translate one Hebrew word. Great sea monsters. They're using that to translate the word taninim.
Okay. So it's not great.
Mm-mm.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's a good question. I'm glad you brought that up. Day six. And Elohim said, let the earth bring forth living souls according to its kind. Cattle and creeping things and living things of the earth after according to its kind. And it was so. And Elohim made the living things of the earth according to its kind, and the cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And Elohim said that it was good. And Elohim said, let's make man in our image, according to our likeness. And they shall rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And Elohim created the Adam. Okay? Doesn't say the man. There are a couple different words used for man in the Bible. The word ish is the most common. It's used over 2,000 times. There's another word, gever, which is also used. But the word used here is the word Adam. This is before it became his name, Adam. But an Adam, it's used a little over 500 times in the Bible. So he made the Adam. Now, what's so important about this? Well, Leviticus 17:14, look what it says. For as for the soul, the nephesh of all flesh is its dam, blood. Its blood is identified with its nephesh. Therefore, I said to the sons of Israel, you are not to eat the dam, the blood of any flesh, for the nephesh of all flesh is its dam, its blood. I know your translations say the life is in the blood. It doesn't say that. It says the nephesh, the soul is in the blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. What I'm doing is what I want to show you here is this. The word dam is the word for blood. Yet where did Adam's soul come from? Remember that letter Aleph, the Lord, the Master of the universe? The first letter of Adam's name is Aleph. The second and third letters of his name are Dam, blood. When you see the name Adam, you're seeing the Almighty, the Lord and Master of the universe, joining with the soul of a created being. This is why we are amphibians. We have a physical body which comes out of the dirt. And we have a soul that is breathed into us from God, who is utterly spiritual. And they come together. God and the dam, this physical stuff. And the soul is in the dam and the blood. And they come together and we become an Adam, a man. You see, it didn't say he became an Ish. He became an Adam. because that word has special meaning. It should be translated human being to be better than just a man, a human being. Because a human being is one who came from the be-er. He's one who has God's spirit as well as an earthly body, physical, spiritual, joined together, meshed together, married together, always to be together. This is so important to God that we remain human beings, that when our bodies die, He will resurrect them and reunite them with our souls so we can continue to be human beings. He wants this to be this way for all of eternity. Flesh and spirit together. All right? That's a powerful concept we have to have in our minds. I want to see your hand up. Can we hold that for a second, Jim? Okay, let me finish this up. And we're going to go and look at the restorations. There's something very important I want to finish with this. On this, the sixth day, we finally see the complete regeneration of a person as he stands in the image of God. He's united to his Creator and has communion with Him. Though God has been speaking all along, the man finally begins to hear His voice. God's been speaking for 6 days, but finally man hears Him. But note the kinds of things God says to Adam. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish, rule over the birds, rule over every living thing that moves on the earth. These are all commandments. You would think that there would be at least be some kind of a greeting. Hi, my name's God. It's great to see you. I've been waiting for 6 days to make your acquaintance. Let me show you around. There's no mention of affection, love, or all the other kinds of things one would expect to hear from God when first meeting Him face to face. No, just commandments, orders, instructions. But wait. Take a closer look at these commandments. God orders Adam, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Isn't this actually an expression of love? God is saying, Adam, I want a whole world filled with people just like you. And then God says, rule over the fish, the birds, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. That would include the taninim, wouldn't it? Here the Creator is implying, Adam, just as you are under my authority, I am placing the entire world under your authority. In this way, you will become like me. This, too, is a great gift from the Creator. He gives Adam the world. And He does so in a way that will allow Adam to become more like the gracious and loving God who created him. You know, what does Yeshua say? What will man exchange his soul for? What does it profit a man if he exchanges his soul for the world? And here, Adam had the whole world, and lost it because he gave his soul away. That's it. We'll get to that later. All of God's commandments are an expression of His love for us. Think about it. Every commandment in the Scriptures. It just irritates me so much when I hear people say, we're not under the law. Oh, what a shame if we are not to obey His commandments. Those commandments are expressions of love. Every commandment is an opportunity for us to become more like Him. Because these commandments proceed from His mind. These commandments reflect how He lives. He says, I'm giving you a gift. I don't give the animals commandments. I'm giving you commandments so that your life can resemble mine. And then when we obey those commandments, those are expressions of our love for Him. All these commandments that He gives Adam the moment Adam wakes up and has ears, all these commandments are expressions of love to Adam and opportunities for Adam to express love back to God. What does the Messiah say? If you love me, you keep my commandments. It's just common sense. But anyways, all of God's commandments are an expression of His love for us, and our obedience is an expression of our love for Him. Thus we see the regenerated soul finding his place in creation. He is under God's authority, but has dominion over the animals. He is given his first instructions, and they are to be fruitful and to multiply. This pictures further development and growth. Though God's work is complete, the man's is just beginning. But before man begins his work, he must first learn of God's rest and enter into it, for it says in the next section, thus the heavens and earth were completed and all their host. And on the seventh day, Elohim completed his work which he had worked, and he rested. He Shabbatted, the word is Shabbat there. And on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So, Adam, here's the work for you to do, but you know what? Just take a day vacation before you get started. I like that. That's pretty awesome. Well, anyways, we've really gone over time, but I hope that this has been a blessing. It's been really meaningful to me putting this together. But do you see these 6 days in a whole new way? And we just scratched the surface, really. But the first chapter of the Bible is the gospel of how God restores human beings to become in His image. We're all involved in this process, aren't we? So, Sharon will give you the last word here.
I'm not
going to go here. Oh, well, I was going to do ladies first. Okay, we'll go to Jim. Go. Oh, sorry. We're going to keep you on your toes, Adam.
Age before beauty, Jim.
So, creation is wonderful. There's really not a meaningful gift till destruction and restoration.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't. You very well put. We don't appreciate the beauty until we've gone through that destruction. Even the emptiness of darkness, confusion, and chaos that we've gone through, even that has purpose. God doesn't call it good, but it becomes the opportunity for us to experience what real good is. And this is why He makes human beings His bride and not angels, because we've been through something they could never go through. We've experienced the distance from God. And we've experienced that restoration. He says, these are the kind of people I want for my bride. It's an incredible thing. Wonderful picture. And the more you study the first chapter of Genesis, the more the last two chapters of Revelation makes sense, because they make a loop. They're really, you know, you say, what's the book for book before Genesis? You should say Revelation. That's the book right before Genesis, because they go right side by side. Yeah. Okay, Sharon.
The first 5 days are described as just a day.
Yeah.
And everything's completed by the end of those 8 days.
Yeah.
But the 6th day has a definitive article. Okay. It's the day. It's specific.
Yeah.
Something very, very special and unique is happening on this day. And you said the first 5 days is completed, then God creates man in His image. We're living in the
yes.
Day. Our
well
existence
put.
And everything is marched forth from Adam and Eve arriving. This is our present world.
Yeah.
We are living in the 6th day, waiting
right.
for our ultimate Shabbat rest. In
that's
the
right.
Messianic.
Well put. That's so true. That's so true. All right. Excellent. Thank you. That's something that the deeper sources discuss. How the 6th day is called the day, and the other 5 aren't. Yeah. All right, we must close in prayer. And Father, we thank You for this time. Thank You so much for Your precious word. Lord, continue to teach us to open our eyes, unveil our eyes, so that we can behold wonders out of Your Torah. And Father, I pray that we would do nothing to stop Your work in our lives prematurely, but we would be faithful to move on with You and allow You to complete a finished work in each of us, that we might be people who lovingly embrace Your commandments to us and walk in Your image. Lord, we have a lot of work to do yet. There's much to be done in our lives. So let us not be complacent, but be people of faithfulness and truth as we walk in Your light, and we'll give You the praise and glory for all of it as our Creator and our Redeemer. In Yeshua's name, amen. Well, let's stand together.